Well, this evening, we turn our attention once more to this book we call Revelation. And our attention tonight is focused on chapter 12 and the latter part of it, verses 10 to 17. To go with our thoughts is this title, Life in the Wilderness. Life in the Wilderness. This is where we find that the woman has been taken to, the wings that she has been given, that have enabled her to escape from the attention of the dragon. And the woman, of course, stands here for the church. We have seen last time, particularly, how her position as the Old Testament church, the true church, prior to Christ's coming, was represented to us there. Her dignity, special station that she had in the eyes of God. And how? Despite the opposition of the dragon, of course the dragon, that is the devil, that ancient serpent, the devil, Satan, accuser, that is the dragon, as pictured to us here, awaits to destroy that child that is to be born. We saw the conflict between the devil and God's people, everything that is precious to God, beginning in the Garden of Eden and pursuing its way through history, why, to this very day. And although this war that we read of there in heaven was ended most decisively when the Lord died on the cross, that bruising of Satan's head, that terminal wound that meant now that the power and access that once he'd enjoyed has suffered a terrible blow, and that now his influences were no longer there to be acceptable in heaven, cast to the earth and the sea, and woe to them indeed. And we find later on, chapter 13, beasts arising out of the sea and out of the earth, that particular division domain that is given to the devil, place of influence and operation there. But the decisive defeat that has been incurred at the cross stands there to show forth the final victory of God's people. And so the woman, the church now, that devil, his efforts to destroy the Lord, destroy his ministry, completely upended in the resurrection, ascension of Christ and his installation in power, their absolute defeats to him. And he knows his time is short, but that doesn't stop him being full of wrath. My first heading is this, an irrational foe, an irrational foe. There is the church in the wilderness standing to us there as a picture of this world. That's what the world is like. It is like a wilderness. There's not much there within its culture, by and large, other than happier times, revival really. Not much there that represents Christ to us. Nothing whereby we get an echo back to us of the things we believe. Doubt that, put on the television, switch on the radio, spend some time there, and you'll quickly realize there's nothing there. Nothing to represent the Christian faith in a particularly positive way. Indeed, most of it will be quite negative. That's the wilderness of the world. It's grey, it's drab for all of its gaudiness and all of its promises of freedom and everything else. It's false, it's empty. And we, who are God's people, seen through it and recognized it for what it is, the wilderness. We don't look there for our nourishment, we look elsewhere. But we find that the dragon has not left us alone. And though we have been given these wings of an eagle to flee from his presence in that way to this wilderness, he follows us and spews out this water like a flood. And we'll consider that a little bit more in a moment. But that's it. Opposition. More opposition. More efforts still to oppose everything that is precious to God. Of course, there is, we might say, nothing more precious to him than his people, the church, the woman, as pictured to us here in this vision. And so he opposes everything to do with that which is precious to God. And there is anger, quite strong anger,
a wrath that he has.
And, well, we know angry people are not the best people to spend time with. How brutal and destructive they are. He's likened, isn't he, as to a roaring lion. Well, you can't reason with a roaring lion. They're just going to do what they do. They're going to be destructive. They're going to lash out. They're going to be fierce and brutal. That's the nature of it. There is a great, great wrath.
But here's the irrationality of it. He knows he's defeated. He knows that he is beaten, that the cross actually, which you might say he never saw that one coming, that has robbed him of all the armour in which he trusted, that has spoiled his kingdom, that has wrecked all his hopes. He has seen that he couldn't see it before. He just didn't realise what was going on. He knew that there was threat in the Son of God coming, but precisely how that would work, well, he didn't see that one. He didn't realise that when Christ looked at his most weak and defeated, when he looked as if he had been scorned, even set aside by God the Father, that was the point at which he was experiencing the greatest victory for his people. And so now the devil knows, that which he didn't know before, that he is truly now, without any prospect whatsoever. And rather than accepting defeat, rather than accepting that he must just leave what is precious to God alone, cease his efforts to try to upset and disrupt, he continues to fight. He fights on, which is really quite irrational. Quite irrational. But we shouldn't look necessarily for reason at times within the devil's work. He's much like a retreating army that is defeated. It's perhaps realized that decisive victory has been scored against it. And rather than its soldiers perhaps preparing for the punishment that they may be going to receive, or the way in which now it would be better to behave well and try to curry favour with the army that's going to win, their behaviour can actually deteriorate. And they treat people that they happen to come across as they retreat violently and angrily and in a very, very vindictive and cruel way, very base way. And it seems really quite irrational that they should so do it. But there is that anger, that wrath, that even though they know they're beaten, even though there is that, it doesn't improve them in terms of their behaviour. Sometimes they even behave more badly. And so there is that measure of irrationality within the devil. Who would keep on fighting when you know that you're beaten? Why continue to wage this war when the end result is already signed and sealed? But in this regard, we cannot credit the devil with overmuch. He's cunning, we know that. There is stratagem there of a kind. But it's not all particularly well thought out. You know, it describes, doesn't it, there, what comes from his mouth as being like a flood. Like a flood. Well, in a way, it's a very clumsy kind of tool to use. Flood is indiscriminate. All kinds of collateral damage might ensue from it, if you can picture it in that way. It's a very blunt instrument, and a very clumsy kind of way of doing his destructive work. And that tells us perhaps something there, that these aren't always cleverly crafted things that he is busy in. His wrath and his anger means that he'll just lash out at times indiscriminately, even if it means that in so doing he might destroy some of those who are working for him in some particular operation there. There doesn't necessarily have to be coherence. Neither should we think of him there as some evil genius out of some Marvel movie or something like this, calculating and always one step ahead of everybody else. No, that again will be to credit him with overmuch. There doesn't have to be coherence or rationality in much that he does. Though there is much that is cunning, much that is clever and sophisticated to a degree, though he comes there at times with that velvet glove that conceals the iron fist. So much of what he does is brutal and cruel, bloodthirsty, indiscriminate, willing that even those who
whether they know it or not, as serving him, might perish in the enterprise as well as others of his operatives surviving.
So there is a degree of indiscriminateness there, bringing together elements that really are non-compatible, but all of which, in some fashion or other, serve to oppose the church, even though these elements may themselves be in a measure of friction and conflict. But if they can serve the purpose, somehow interfering with or impeding the progress of the gospel, then that's good enough. It doesn't have to be logical or rational or thought through. In his anger and in his wrath, in a sense, anything will do. And so we find that there are liberal Christians, those who deny most of the revelation of the Bible. Well, they team up with atheists, which is remarkable. Think of quite incompatible people in a way. The atheists realize rightly that the liberal Christians hardly really much believe in the God of the Bible, and so they all do, and they form alliances against creationism, and stand there as one, and speak as one, and speak down the view that God made the world in 6 days. So that's a strange alliance. Or, this perhaps is the weirdest one today, but it's a strong one, you get groups of people who would identify many of them as being atheists, would many of them identify with being anti-creationism, pro-abortion, pro-homosexuality. They are teamed up with those who are radical Islamists, people who want to bring Sharia law, people who want to bring difficulty to Western nations and gradually subdue them, bring them under subjection to Islam. Which is quite irrational, quite incoherent, that people who are pro-abortion, anti-creation, should actually think that they've got more in common with people that are in support of Islam rather than with Christians. And so you get these strange alliances, because it doesn't have to be rational. You don't have to rely upon logic and consistency in this. Any of these will do in the devil's effort to try to destroy the Christian church and her witness. For that's the united aim. There, whether it be religious convictions, whether it be atheist convictions that are working strongly, and atheist convictions we can credit with being religious convictions in that way, their efforts are to destroy the church. Even though it might look this sort of indiscriminate flood, this bringing together just of one tidal force there, rushing through and pushing all sorts of things away, and indeed even pushing away some of those who work for the devil in that way. It matters not, long as it works against the church. It is as though in the devil's language, saying is, isn't it, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. It doesn't matter that we haven't got actually much in common. If we sat down long enough, we'd find plenty to disagree with. Never mind. We're united in our opposition to that enemy there. We have a common enemy, so that's reason enough for us to be friends and to work together. So we have irrational alliances and irrational actions, and plenty of collateral damage that can take place. The devil can tolerate Shiites and Sunnis killing each other there, or whatever it might be, apostate forms of Christianity fighting against Islam in other places at other times. Just so long as united in their opposition to the true church, they at least have that common cause there. Within it, the aim to silence the church, to oppose, to frighten, to immobilize. And that flood, well, we can think of it in various ways. It comes as false religions and false teachings and utopias that are promised by some political activist there, and philosophies that are stripped bare of any moral content, Christian moral content, and which explicitly deny the reality of a creator and a judge. All of it thrown together there, as we've said, some of it quite incompatible. And really, if these people sat down a bit longer, they'd surely end up disagreeing with each other more violently. But they find a common cause here, under the devil's, as it were, overruling government. So he is an irrational foe. And it shouldn't surprise us to find that often, it's incredible, most absurd kinds of alliances are being formed
and the opposition that comes against us is ridiculous and intellectually shallow.
He's an irrational foe. He's angry.
And in his anger, well, he's trying anything to try to upset and disrupt the progress of the gospel. Which brings us then to our second heading. The Lord is our helper. An irrational foe and the dragon, the devil. Well, we have the Lord as our helper. Hear the voice that spoke in heaven in verse 10, now salvation and strength, and the kingdom of our God, and the power of his Christ have come. The accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. Salvation, strength, and the kingdom. There is something beyond that, which God is supplying to his people in the new covenant that he denied them in the old covenant. Fullness of revelation, and a fullness of the power of the Holy Spirit to go with that. That whereas, I read that in Vin Spurgeon the other week there, whereas in the Old Covenant times, the prosperity was the expectation, in New Covenant times, adversity is more the expectation. To go with that, this dimension of salvation and strength, this more full manifestation of the kingdom of our God, accompanies that. And so here we find ourselves, yes, in the wilderness. That's where God has sent us there, away from the sort of more populated areas, as you might conceive of them, in this vision, there in the wilderness, and able to provide for them quite comfortably, quite easily. You would think that's the last place to go. People are hungry, needy, if there is a famine. You would not advise them, go into the wilderness. Last place, you think, that you'll be helped or find any provision. That is no difficulty for the Lord. Put the church in the most unpromising of environments, in a culture that is opposed to it. He will find a way to feed his people and encourage them. He rules with that rod of iron. Salvation belongs to the Lord. And he will prevail for his people so that they can prevail. And though they be in the wilderness, they will find food. They will find comforts, and they will find water coming from the rock. They'll find provision there. And the illustration of this rather readily comes to us from the Old Testament in the shape of Elijah. That this great man of God, and we thought a little of him on Thursday evening in Romans chapter 11, but here we find him, time of great apostasy, read there of Ahab and marrying Jezebel, daughter there of the Sidonian king, and introducing the Baals into the northern kingdom. A northern kingdom which, as the word of God tells us already, had been grossly infected by the sins of Jeroboam, the idols that had been made, the calves that they were worshipping in different places, and now, to add insult to injury, a Baal worship. Temple of Baal there in Samaria. This is a wilderness indeed. And as though to portray it very graphically, in this time of immense droughts, it was actually brought by God. We hear again those words which were given to Elijah in 1 Kings 17, just reading from verse 2. The word of the Lord came to him, saying, get away from here, and turn eastward, and hide by the brook Cherith, which flows into the Jordan. And it will be that you shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. For he went and stayed by the brook Cherith, which flows into the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. And it happened after a while that the brook dried up, because there had been no rain in the land. But of course it doesn't end there. Just when it looks as if the whole thing's coming into difficulty for Elijah, he's instructed to go to Zarephath, and he finds that widow there in that neighbouring area of Sidon. Sidon had been the place of difficulty, but there is mercy that God is showing to the widow there from Zarephath, whom the Lord mentions when he preaches in Luke chapter 4 in Nazareth. So to her he goes, and there's provision. Literally, food that is available, miraculously. How the bread there can be supplied, the oil doesn't run out, the jar of flour is never empty until that drought has come to an end.
a literal wilderness, a drought, a famine that had afflicted the whole land, where it seemed impossible to find anything to drink and anything to eat. First of all, there's the brook Cherith. Precarious, it might seem, little trickling water into the Jordan, but it still comes, it still works. And then these wonderful ravens, whom the Lord appoints to bring food there to the prophet, morning and evening. Provision in the wilderness. What a wilderness it was too. Ravens that God can command and send there in this miraculous way to provide for the prophet in his time of particular need. And the Lord, in that picture there, taking it to be now the church, what we see happening with Elijah, the Lord provides for his people in the wilderness still, and can appoint for them quite remarkable helps and encouragements, as though the ravens still are flying, and still bringing their food to assist us morning, noon, and night. And Elijah has not been distant from our thinking. He was there really in Revelation chapter 11, and the two witnesses, and they're standing there for the word of God in those difficult times. So God provides in the wilderness for his people. The Lord is our helper. Even though the dragon be sending floods of false teaching and all kinds of disruptions there to our work, he provides for his people. The woman, first of all, to reach the wilderness, is given those wings of an eagle. What a picture of dignity that is. All the troubles there, and yet, well, see an eagle flying high in the sky and able to cruise along there. It's so effortless, so wonderful to see. And that is the church. She may look as if she's struggling, but she's given wings of an eagle. She's actually prevailing. She is actually soaring in this regard, high above it all. The devil and all his grubby works and the foolish words of men animated by his spirit. And there she is, sailing above it. Able literally at times to escape from persecution, being warned of it, able to escape from it, as were the disciples there from Jerusalem when the Romans were coming, and enabled to flee and go to another place and to experience the help of God in that. And God's people have, through history, at different times, known that trouble was coming and been able to take action, given those wings of an eagle, to escape brutality. Think of the Pilgrim Fathers. We think of their journey over to the United States. That's in the news, isn't it? Very much there. Landing there in what we call New England. Sensing, reading the times rightly, that there was trouble coming. This blessing came upon those who remained, like John Bunyan and people, but the massive troubles that they experienced, and great ejection and everything that that brought. And so the Pilgrim Fathers reviewed that evidence, considered just what might transpire, and in the main their assessments were correct, and decided better to go, given those wings of an eagle, if you like, to be able to establish a new settlement and to see great blessing where they were, revivals which we still read about to this day. And then there is the earth. In a way, this unexpected assistance that the earth gives. Who has ever heard of a flood, and then the earth kind of opens up and the water just sort of pours down the hole? Providences, ways in which God can assist his people, helps that you never had thought would have been possible. There's Elijah, brooks run dry, where now? Where's he going to find help? But from this widow, not even from Jewish stock, not even an Israelite, there across in Sidon. And she has been appointed to help him, is ready to assist. When he comes, it's as though she knows all about him and is ready to follow his word. With what great good outcome follows, feeding her own family and able to feed him at the same time. The earth can open up unexpected helps. God is able to appoint for his people. Changes in government, changes of judges, who knows Brexit yet? Removal of unhelpful people from situations, managers perhaps at work, or unhelpful people who are making life difficult, and suddenly they've gone. And the reasons behind it may be quite extraordinary and quite convoluted, but the earth has opened up there and swallowed up something of the flood that may have been pursuing us and making our life difficult. And this nourishment that is spoken of in Revelation 12, verses 6 and verses 14, the power and the strength of God's provision. What is the secret of this? Well, we find something of it described to us there in verse 11 of Revelation chapter 12, that they are relying upon the blood of the Lamb. That's how they overcome. They're relying upon that, that their trust is absolutely rooted in that. Nothing else. Their own lives, they've discounted those, as we read, they did not love their lives to the death, because they're relying on the blood of the Lamb to be able to answer for them beyond death, beyond all the removal of temporal advantages and their reputations gone down the drain or anything else like that. They're relying on that. And there, God is pleased to own them as his people and to bless them. So they're looking to that. They're looking to the power that is in the blood to keep his people. And there is their testimony, spoken of in verse 11 and in verse 17. Their confession of these realities. Their belief that they are willing to speak of to those who are antagonized and are part of the devil's flood that's against them. Their willingness to back down, but actually to speak up. And this, too, brings the damning of their foes, eventually. But that will be there, part of the whole indictment against them, that they heard from the lips of God's people the testimony of Jesus and rejected it. And that is glorifying to Christ, that he holds his people, that they still will speak for him, that they love him so much and much more than they love their own lives, that still they spoke of him under great duress. And they keep the commandments of God. There is also part of their secret, which we read of in verse 17. They keep the commandments of God. They're nourished in the path of obedience, doing all that he has instructed, living there as best they can, upright, godly, holy lives. Doing this despite the low premium that's put on it by the wider society. And living such lives, relying upon the blood, testifying to Christ, living according to his truth, attracts to them the love of Christ. The love of Christ that comes to feed the souls of such people. Right there, out in the wilderness, in this most inhospitable terrain, fed and watered and nourished. That as they look to Christ, the Lord himself comes to dwell with them and to bring them very good things. So earlier in the book of Revelation, we read in chapter 2, there in verse 17, the promise to the church at Pergamos, that he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat. Provision. Manna. Manna which was there in the wilderness, available to the people, they could gather it, it was sufficient for them, it nourished them. And he can provide that still for his people in this wilderness that is the world that we are in. Provides manna. Or as we read in John's Gospel, chapter 14, verse 21 and verse 23, when the Lord said, he who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me. He who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. It's nourishment. He comes to his people and manifests himself to them. Or verse 23 of that same chapter. Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. My Father will love him. We will come to him and make our home with him. Out in the wilderness, able to do just that. Father, Son, and Spirit, making their home in the believer, bringing comforts, joy, hope, warmth, and assurance of the affection of God toward them.
out in the hostile, howling wilderness, where the winds blow strong and this flood that the devil unleashes spewing out from his mouth, as it is so graphically described. No matter. For those who are reliant on Christ and are obeying him, then the Son will come and draw near to such a soul. Those who are overcoming the temptations to collapse, temptation to fear, those who are resisting the flood and saying no to it, to them the Lord comes and appoints blessing, sending ravens. He himself comes and makes his home with such a believer. So in the wilderness, which we're in, we should be confident. We should be confident. God's promises, and they're here in Revelation chapter 12, are good and pure and to be relied upon. And I'm sure we've already proven something of their value in our pilgrimage to date. We should be encouraged and confident that God can provide for any one of his people, whoever they are, however weak their faith or strong their faith. He can provide for them in that wilderness to nourish them, to come and to manifest his love to them, which is so vital to us. We have no strength if we're not assured of the love of God. To know that is absolutely vital. And through the Bible, through coming to church, being with each other, hearing the word of God, and all the means of grace, our communion table, then these things are part of that nourishment, part of the way in which he comes, makes his home with such a people who are living in the wilderness, with the devil and his flood pursuing them, but who have learnt not to fear, that there will be provision, as it was for Elijah. There will be provision for all of his people, whatever the age, and if this age were to get worse than it presently is, fear not. This promise will stand fast, and we, by his grace, will prove its value and its reality. There we are, a church in the wilderness, where the Lord provides life and help for his people.